upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Races and about 25 into hour two, and thank Jay Hubdy for his visit, and we'll stay in the same town actually, and we'll stay with Jay's two Jays, and Jay Hubdy joins us. Jay, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Jay, 93.
Of course, you have violated the one of the first rules of programming,
which is.
You don't follow a comedian with a comedian. You don't follow a guy named Jay who dotes on Mel Studi with a guy named Jay who dotes on Mel Studi.
What can I do? I don't think it mattered what name I was going to come up with. There was going to be people doting on Mel Studi.
So true. So true.
I mean, I only knew him just a tiny bit. And you know, from a handful of years ago when he would, you know, he hadn't been at the track as often, but you know, as he got much older, but you know, it's one of those.
And shame on you. I mean, your life was poor for it. You know,
that's true.
That's one of the things. And of course, out here in the West Coast, which is, I mean, separated by a vast continent of mountain ranges and thankless desert crossings and wild rivers from the you know the vaunted east. You know, we've been camping out with the wild people here in terms of horse racing recognition forever. I mean, it's been ever so. Mel Studi should have been a name on everyone's lips from the mid '60s onward up until he stopped training. He should have been. People should have been kneeling at his feet from coast to coast, but no, he's pigeonholed into he's a California speed trainer, and you know he had to do things with Snow Chief and very subtle, you know, shoving them down the throats of the East Coast elite, you know, to get any degree of recognition at all. It's very frustrating, and you know, as a native Californian. I'm prejudiced, but there it is. So we were proud to have him for as long as we were able to, and 93 years wasn't enough.
Talk about you know your early encountering of Studi, and how he certainly was approachable. I mean, that part isn't in question. Was he kind of a counterbalance to Whittingham to a degree?
No, he was a counterbalance to Warren, his brother.
There you go.
There was no counterbalance to Whittingham, by the way. there was a reason that Charlie was called the Pope, because he was infallible. But, no, I mean, Warren was Warren and Mel Studi were very much the yin and yang of the you know, the human behavior spectrum. It was almost as if Mel lived his life in apologies for the gruff, unforgiving public persona that Warren maintained. But Warren was a pussycat at heart as well. These guys were raised on a farm around, you know, dairy cows and chickens and such, and you know they were handling animals, you know, the way that we handle keyboards. I mean, that was just their second nature. And that was the great thing about trainers from not only that era, but that particular upbringing, is that they had a respect for the creature that was kind of founded in that we're in this together. We are training each other. When it comes to what a thoroughbred horse can do. And, of course, a thoroughbred is a creature unique as the unicorn in many ways. But you know, as my colleague Jay Prudman outlined, Mel was not shy about asking horses to do things at a rate and a pace that other trainers might have been a little bit more reluctant to do, because he respected what they could do. He knew what the thoroughbred was capable of doing if it was fed and conditioned and cared for properly. And whether or not we see that same kind of philosophy going forward today, given the left and right hand turns both the breed and the craft has taken, that's another discussion. But Mel was he was not unique among trainers of that era at all. He just did it a little bit better, and he had instincts for the waif and the poorly bred or the forgotten horse that came his way.
Well, and that part of it came up with Jay earlier about the parade of modestly purchased and commonly bred horses that he crafted into successes.
Yeah, well, I have the advantage on my much younger colleague Jay Pribben that I got to know Mel from the early 70s on. And in that era, I mean, he was one of the guys. He was one of the ones. You just, if you were taking roll on a stakes race coming up, Mel would have one nominated. He might not have three nominated like Charlie or Farrell Jones or some of those guys, Bob Wheeler back then, but he would have one in there. He'd have a horse in just about every mix. And the two that really stand out from that era of the early to into the mid and late 70s were, the first one was Double Discount, which is a homebred from Ken Shipper, one of the real linchpin individuals of the California breeding industry. He was the proprietor of the Hat Ranch. If that name rings any dim bells, that'd be great. Ken was, Ivy League educated, cowboy boot wearing fellow that provided Mel with a lot of hot stock. I mean, really some real fine runners. Double Discount was versatile enough in Mel's hands to have won the San Carlos at 7 furlongs and set an American turf record for 1.25 miles in the Carlton Burg. And given that that's a little bit downhill, you put an asterisk by it, but he still ran very fast that day. And he mixed it up with a lot of good horses. And the other one, of course, the one that really put Mel on kind of a national consciousness early was Telly's Pop. That was the horse that was owned by Howard Koch, the Hollywood producer and director, and Telly Savalas, who was like A-list of A-lists at that time with his Kojak character on TV and the whole persona that he was bringing to the races. And that was such a kick to have that two-year-old just tearing through California during that 1975 late season with Telly Savalas and his entourage showing up. It got bigger and bigger as the horse won more and more races along the way. That was such a hoot. And Mel was the impresario of that whole thing, kind of standing back and watching it happen.
Well, and of course, for those that hear the name Howard Koch, I've discussed Howard with Billy, his grandson, and I know Billy has spoke and written glowingly about about Mel. And
well, Mel and Telly, Telly's Pop provided one of the single most hilarious episodes at the races that I ever witnessed, and certainly in my younger years at the racetrack. Savalas, of course, was not a shy guy. He was an out there kind of guy's guy, and a real symbol of everything that in your face kind of enjoying life. And he was having so much fun with Telly's Pop that Rod Steiger, the Academy Award-winning actor, he had to get a horse. So he got involved with a horse named Stained Glass, and it was trained by Joe Manzi, one of Mel's a little bit younger contemporaries, not much. And Joe, you know, developed Stained Glass into a very good horse. And the Telly's Pop and Stained Glass met in a race early at Santa Anita in, I guess, 76 or was it late 75. And, of course, Telly Savalas was there with his entourage, and it was getting bigger all the time. And Steiger didn't have quite the posse, so he was sitting in a box at one level, and the Savalas group was in a tier above them, just, you know, filling overflowing boxes. Well, Stained Glass beat Telly's Pop on the square, and Steiger turns around and singles out Savalas in the crowd and flips him off with the most flamboyant gesture that you would ever want to find. I mean, it's not on film and not on tape, but believe me, it's burned into my mind's eye. It was hilarious. It was a great day. That's, and now that is a racetrack rivalry.
That's tremendous. That's tremendous.
Thank you, Mel Studi, for making that possible.
Well, and it also, you know, it also speaks to the glamour that's been so, you know, ingrained in Southern California racing. And
well, that's true. When Mel finally got a patron that was more than just a guy that owned a car wash or a bar, it was Dolly Green, the heiress to Beverly Hills. And what does he do? He develops a champion for her. I mean, that's, you know, imagine if he had been given that kind of stock over and over and over again, you know, we would have been, you know, dusting his plaque in the Hall of Fame for the last 25 years.
Well, and, you know, that topic, of course, the clamor, there was a clamor to get him in the Hall of Fame.
Well, he was on the ballot several times, so shame on the Hall of Fame voting block for not recognizing a Hall of Fame record when they see it. I mean, they had their chance many times, and then, you know, I mean, it's, I guess the Hall of Fame nominating committee, of which I'm a member, finally took no for an answer from the voter, voting membership, and just said, well, you know, I guess Mel is simply not palatable to the expanse of experience that has been brought to the table by the Hall of Fame voting membership. I scratch my head until it bleeds, but there you go. We'll be doing the same thing with Barkley, unless he gets social media campaign that got King Leatherby into the Hall of Fame. Barkley will be left on the outside looking in as well.
Well, you wrote a piece that in doing the work to, you know, to kind of round out some of the conversation, you wrote a piece in 2011, the case for Mel Studi in the Hall of Fame. I will send that out.
Yeah, well, I was either way ahead or way behind the times. I'm never sure. I'm never right on the times. So, you know, there you go. I don't think there's any, you know, you could stack him up against some of the other Hall of Fame trainers who have been elected to the Hall of Fame in terms of their accomplishments. And the only thing that is different is that Mel did it in California. And that's literally the only thing different. A classic win, two champions, an array of graded stakes winners that spans the decades, you know, all those kinds of things that you look at as requirements for the Hall of Fame. There's a lot of trainers that have done that, and they've reached the entry level bar, not the Baffert or the Frankel or the Whittingham, but the guys that you just said, yeah, those are Hall of Famers too. And I mean, that's been in parentheses behind Mel's name among his contemporaries, especially in California, for a long, long time. All you have to look at sometimes is who they compete against and who they beat. And if a guy is beating other Hall of Famers with horses that are measurably, let's just say, lower down the food chain in terms of either price or conformation or breeding or whatever, but he's accomplishing the same things that they are, that's a math that seems pretty simple.
Yeah, I started to vote at the tail end of the candidacy, and it seems that there's constant. Yeah, there's a constant. Maybe Steve Askin can even address this too, because Steve has gone to bat for horses in some cases with the Veterans Committee, as it were, the post election type induction process. But
and Steve makes some very good points, and that's a topic for a whole another 3 hours on the big show. But
exactly.
And the fact that Mel Studi is not in the National Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame in Saratoga Springs takes absolutely nothing away from what that man represented as a trainer, and as a father, a grandfather, a brother to one tough nut of a guy, and a friend to all of us, who we just wanted to learn about racing. We wanted to hear some stories. We wanted to kind of let it, peel back the mystique a little bit. And Mel would shrug and fan his mutual tickets at you and invite you to sit in his box and share the day. And, the buzzword has always been transparency. Well, man, that was Mel Studi personified.
As I said to Jay too earlier, when you see a career like his, and you see success over decades and decades with different kinds of horses too, and horses that were able to make it early on as 2-year-old successes, and then continue as older horses and maintain the success. It's really just a spotlight of a showcase of
and
ability.
Have 10 kinds
this
of
game.
Fun doing it.
That's being underreported, actually, is how much, because do you sense, in fact, on that topic, Jay, that it's just, it's become so business-like, and, there's such scrutiny that and resentment of anybody that, when it comes to the horseman side, particularly, that anybody that is having fun seems to be, seems to be under real scrutiny with the public access that we and the social media aspects.
Well, we have entered into a real button down kind of delivery of personalities of the game, which is kind of the bane to my business, because it's tough to make entertainment out of reading the Agate and the Wall Street Journal, which is the way a lot of horsemen deliver the news of their chosen profession these days. But that could be a symptom of a deeper, broader kind of scrutiny on what they what they're trying to do, what they're trying to accomplish with these very, tough, delicate animals. Perhaps a certain amount of seriousness is warranted. And, it's a blood sport, and things get hurt, and all those kinds of things. And Mel was keenly aware of that. Mel said to me one time, I'll leave you with this. And this, not leave you, but I mean, Mel was, we talk about how hard, quote unquote, he trained horses. Like, hard being a pejorative term. He train them to get fit, as Jay Pribman pointed out. If that's hard training, well, everybody should be training hard. I mean, come on. But Bell told me one day, and this was in a rash of, I think it was at Del Mar maybe 7 or 8 years ago when there was some a real spike in injuries and in breakdowns. He said, you know, a trainer has two horses die in the track. He should lose his license for a year. And I'm thinking, yeah, Mel, you might be right. that might be legislating morality in the right way. That might be changing behavior. So Mel was he respected the horse so much that he knew that he was in it with them, and he wanted the horses to enjoy their life and do their work right and get something out of it, and then he would be able to do the same thing.
Well, Mel Studi, and we're looking forward. I'm sure I'm going to feather in a couple more, if not today, then soon. John Sadler.
I haven't taken Steve Haskins' time, have I?
No, we're fine. We got plenty. That's the beauty of a three hour cruise. Like
a 3 hour
cruise.
Yeah, it's amazing. And there's nobody to come out and get you on the island, Steve. You're stuck.
Jay, I appreciate it, and I there's certain people that I get to admire from afar and get to know just a tiny bit, and Mel Studi was one of those.
Well, this has been great talk therapy for me, because you know, I mean, I was so depressed about Mel's passing that I watched a Terrence Malick movie last night. I mean,
Is it over yet? You probably have another 4 hours yet.
No. I watched it all and just sighed at the end. But you know, but it's been great listening to Jay and being able to talk about Mel and you know, yeah. I mean, racing lost a friend. Simple as that.
Well. Jay Hubdy, everybody, and there's plenty of things I could bring up with Jay, including, by the way, the Ferran Peterson story, which almost sounds like a movie, and it might be by the time we get through this meet if she wins the riding title at Monmouth.
Well, we can talk about that later, but I have the telephone number of somebody else that you could probably talk to about that a lot better.
Well, we've been on the. You know, we've been on that on that stump with Ferran Peterson. Really amazing. She's doing
They're in your ballpark now, buddy.
True.
Just out here trying to get Del Mar around the course.
Well, and we're well into now this weekend, second half for both Del Mar and Saratoga. Jay Hovde, everybody, a treat always, even under these circumstances. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Be well.
Jay Hubdy, folks, and more on Mel Studi, I'm sure. Alex Solis, and I want to reach, and we always like to get the rider perspectives as well. I'm sure Steve Haskin, who's going to join us next, I'm sure Steve has got some Snow Chief things, and we'll. We'll see what he's got to contribute, and John Sadler, I know wants to visit, so we'll get more in. One of those, you have a career like that, decades upon decades. So Steve Haskin will join us next. Meanwhile, keeping an eye on waiting for the changes, and I. Dick actually brought up a race where today at Saratoga, that starter allowance, which is a very good group, and the eighth that comes before the state bred stake. And when Tony joins us after Steve, Collegeville Girl in today, and she's a inflated price. She's 15-1 in here, and she's not a likely winner, but she certainly, I think, has got a real chance in here. And you got newly minted 7-5, Radikowski, 6-5, Mrs. Orb, Mike Maselli, 6-1, and Collegeville Girl, 15-1. But there's reason to believe with Collegeville. So we'll see what Tony has to say. He hasn't been at the track all that much, but I'm sure he's got some thoughts about his favorite filly of recent vintage, Collegeville Girl. Steve Haskin of Secretariat.com joins us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Just call me Big Red or Little Red.
No, there, that's pretty good. I had thought that they're, you know, given the nice relationship with Leonard Lusky and the things you've done previously, and actually I think Lenny may have dropped a hint a couple of weeks back, so it made perfect sense. Tell everybody about joining the Secretariat.com concept.
I'm very thrilled. You know, I've worked with Leonard for several years, and we've done a lot of the festivals together, and I've run tours and sold merchandise for him, my photos and signed photos along with Ron Turcotte, and done stories for him, and, you know, with press releases. Like I said, not only did I lead tours, but also gave talks, spoke in front of a lot of the people there, did meet and greets and stuff like that. So I think sort of Leonard needed somebody to replace, you know, Bill Knack as sort of the journalistic spokesman for Secretariat. Not many of us are still around who were there when he ran, who was close to him. So it's been a great relationship. Every year we do the Secretariat Festival in Kentucky, and also we do the Secretariat Birthday Celebration in Doswell, Virginia, at, you know, the Old Meadow Farm, what's left of it, which is only a couple of barns. But we would give tours of that, too, and been working very closely with Kate Tweedy, and, you know, she's Penny's daughter, and she's terrific. So it's been a lot of fun. It really has. And Leonard is a person who gets things done. Believe me, he's the quintessential marketer. He knows how to sell, and he just does things the right way. We've always had a great relationship. And, you know, at first he had talked about, you know, helping me start my own website, and then it sort of evolved into, hey, listen, why not just write for Secretariat.com, bring some people in there, branch out a little bit, and it's great. I mean, the response, you know, I've had my first column up ready. I did this story on Eddie Sweat's new headstone, which got great response. You know, as did the announcement. Leonard wrote a great press release, and, you know, it's just been answering Facebook comments and emails, and, you know, people have been so kind. And you know what? It's the kind of people at this stage of my career and of my life, these are the kind of people I want to write for. It's futile these days to write about the issues. It should be done, but I'm just not the person to do it. To write about the druggings and the medications and all the things that are wrong with horse racing, and, you know, how to try and fix them, which you can't. As long as we don't have a commissioner, we're not going to fix it. So, I just want to have fun writing. I want to write for horse lovers and racing lovers. And, you know, still throw in, you know, a lot of the betting aspects, because I'm going to continue my Derby. I want to say Derby Dozen, but it's not. It's now Derby Rankings. And they're going to, first one is up tomorrow. I got a very extensive Derby Rankings coming up. I rank 15 horses, but it's going to be, you know, very similar to the, almost identical, really, to the Derby Dozen, same kind of comments. But just like I said, just a different audience, and a lot of people from the blog have already emailed me and have already commented on the Eddie Sweat story. So a lot of the commenters from the Blood Horse blog have already come over. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to be writing what I want to write about horses, about history, about human interest stories, things like that. It's not, I don't want people to think I'm just writing about Secretariat. There can be a lot of stuff associated with Secretariat. I'll be writing about Ruffian. I'll be writing about Bold Ruler, things like that. But I'll be writing about all horses. And I'm going to read just basically what I was doing before. So I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Nice, really nice. There's a lot of harmony to it, and it feels like it'll kind of feed upon itself in terms of those trips when people are allowed to make trips again and so forth. There's a nice harmony to this, Steve. Well done.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm looking forward to it.
Turn our attention, before actually we turn our attention to Tis the Law and Art Collector and where we stand on the road to Derby, any Mel Studi brushes to relay and some Snow Chief appreciation?
Well, you know, Mel didn't come east very often. He came east, just a few times. But, I've met him on several occasions, and I certainly can't... I can't get into him the way the two Jays, they did. Obviously, Jay Huffy had some great stories about him. My favorite, believe it or not, my favorite Mel Studi story really only involves Mel in an indirect way, but it's still something that I still laugh about. And Wayne Hughes still laughs. Every time we see each other, Wayne Hughes just cracks up laughing. It was in the 2009 Kentucky Derby when Warren Studi, who was completely the opposite of Mel, and Mel, for anybody who never met him, you talk to Mel for like 2 minutes, and it's like talking to your favorite uncle. I mean, he was just a very warm, really warm, tender guy. And Warren Studi, who I think had come to the Derby like 50 years before with his previous Derby starter, and he was kind of gruff, and... He came, and he would wear the same clothes every day. He wore these khaki pants and his khaki jacket. And he had this horse, Greeley's Galaxy, who was a nice horse. I believe he won the Illinois Derby, I think. He was a pretty nice horse. And so anyway, he brought Warren Studi to the Derby. Well, any reporter that went up to Warren Studi and asked him a question about his horse, say... So, Warren, how'd your horse go today? What do you think of the horse? And he always had the same answer to them. Did you vote for my brother for the Hall of Fame? And if you said no, he would not talk to you. He went around the whole time at that Derby, by the way, campaigning for Mel to be into the Hall of Fame. And this is back in 2009. But if you did not vote for Mel for the Hall of Fame, he would not talk to you. So, I always found that very... very interesting. And another thing, to show you the character of Mel Studi, when he ran Snow Chief in the Derby, after the race was over, he came on the racetrack when he brought Snow Chief back, and Snow Chief was being unsaddled. And he's like a disappointed father who wants to scold his son, but he wants to let him know that he still loves him. And he went over to Snow Chief, and he just put his arms around his neck, and he looked at him, and he says, "You little stinker," and it was just something so heartwarming about it. He was so disappointed in the way Snow Chief ran, but he still wanted to give him some love while scolding him at the same time. But that was the kind of guy Mel Studi was. And the other time I spoke to him at length was when he actually came to the Derby when his son Gary had Papa Clem running in the Derby. That was in 2009. And he would sit at the barn, and he would just support his son. And he was very close to Papa Clem, and obviously, was rooting very hard for Gary. And he would come out to the barn and sit there and talk. It was just great talking to him. He was just a wonderful, wonderful guy. I wish I had known him better, but from the times I did meet him, they were very special occasions.
Nice, perfect. I appreciate it, and I knew that there'd be some. Brushes. It's impossible. The late opportunity to see him and get to know him in California, and he. I remember. I know we're never going to find this, and this is one of the difficulties from the old days of the show when it was recorded on CDs. There was something. There was a Snow Chief anniversary that I reached out and had him on, and you know, we had Gary on many times with too with during Papa Clem with his run. So great respect, and I got to sit there a few times at that table. Barry Abrams would call me over, and you better have a shell like an armadillo to take the take the business you're going to get sitting at that table. It's there's a lot of ribbing and good-natured good-natured jibing, really a real part of Southern California, not just Southern California, racing history. The one thing I'd love to get when Gary joins us in a few weeks, it's always hard immediately afterward, but I'd love to hear the story of him and his brother going out west from coming from the Midwest, and they went out and started their careers, and it's obvious that they had like a real specific intent to go out and work and become part of the business on the West Coast. I'd love to hear, some of the family origin portion of it as well. Well, Steve, let's get into the last two big preps. We still have got a Pegasus to run Saturday at Monmouth, and kind of the Lexington of the schedule.
very well put.
Give us your take on what we saw Saturday and Sunday, Travers and the Ellis Park Derby.
Well, I don't know if you remember. Do you remember a song that Tennessee Ernie Ford did called where there's a line where he says, "If the left one don't get you, then the right one will."
Yeah,
the
sure.
Song 16 Tons.
Yeah.
I don't remember that song. Well, that's this year's Derby. If tis the Lord don't get you, I collect the will. I mean, there's just, you talk about a 1-2 punch. If for some reason, if for some strange reason, you manage to beat tis the law, then good luck trying to beat our collector. I mean, it's to me, it's going to take an extraordinary performance. Now, again, we don't know how good Honor AP is or because of his last race, and we went over that, and if he's as good as advertised, and if you throw out the last race, and he did have a few excuses in my mind, but still an arduous task for him to get to the Derby off that one race in 13 weeks. But these two horses coming to the Derby, Tis the Law, I thought, was so impressive in the Travers. Listen, I keep calling him the machine, and that's what he is. I mean, here's a horse who would have been a big favorite in the Derby in May and is still the big favorite in the Derby in September. So credit Barkley Tag for that and the resilience of the horse, who just keeps going and going and getting better. We thought he looked good coming off the Holy Bull in the Florida Derby. But after the Belmont Stakes and the Travers, and he's already got a mile and a quarter race on the rim, so there's obviously no question about that. He's only the sixth horse in history to break 201 for the Travers, and we're talking about some pretty hefty horses that have done it, and a lot of great horses who haven't done it. But he just runs the same race every time. He's always in the same spot every single time. He's going to be laying right off you, and he's going to be sitting. And he had that race won at the 5/8 pole. And if you saw the way Manny Franco was sitting on him, just with a ton of horse under him, and he just has such a high cruising speed that he was in total control of that race. I mean, you watch Uncle Chuck in front, and you're saying, this horse doesn't have a shot. And when they go, you're going to go 48 with a horse with that kind of cruising speed, he's just going to sit and sit and just going to go whenever he wants to. And the way he drew off like that, he's. If he stays in training as a four-year-old, he's going to be even better. He's still got a touch of greenness in him, no matter what. It doesn't matter. I think he still likes to look around a little bit and might lose a little bit of focus, but he just keeps running. He's just so strong. And if you look at him from a physical standpoint, it's like an old-fashioned horse. He's just he you know, strong boned horse, muscular. He's just made of, you know, like they say, spit and vinegar. Well, that's him. He just keeps going, going, and going, and it's going to take a monster effort to beat him in the Derby. And then the next day, we had the privilege of seeing Art Collector. And the one thing I learned about him, if he does have a slight advantage over Tis the Law, is that he's a bit more versatile. He can beat you on a lead, which he's done twice. He can beat you sitting right off the pace, which he's done. He can beat you coming from 7 or 8 lengths off the pace, which he's done. So his versatility, obviously, is going to go a long way in the Derby. Do I think he's ready to beat Tis the Law? Probably not. I think Tis the Law is a better horse, but he's not that far behind. And he's just getting better and better and better. He's just become a winning machine now. So good luck trying to beat both of these horses. I mean, they're both very impressive. And I also have to point out, by the way, the runner-ups and runners-up in both those races. You know, Caracaro, I've talked about ad nauseum already, you know, about finding him in January or so, but you watch, he ran an incredible race for such a lightly raced horse. You know, coming off the one race in 6 months and coming back again in 3 weeks, going a mile and a quarter against Tis the Law. And, you know, he made a really nice move on the turn to get into contention. And then Max Player comes flying up outside of him, you know, out just wide, right on the outside. And it looked like Max Player, you know, he had the momentum. He's a closer. He said, all right, well, Max Player is going to be second, and Caracaro will probably be third. And Caracaro just drew away from him and finished 2 lengths ahead of him. And I thought he ran a terrific race. He's going to be a really, really good horse. Whether he's ready to beat Tis the Law and Art Collector, probably not. But he's got a big shot to really make his presence felt in there. And the other horse I have to point out, Attachment Rate, who I have had in the top 12 several times. I'm waiting for this horse to show what he could do, because I remember when he broke his maiden, he just looked so strong. I just loved everything about him. I loved the way he moved. I loved everything about him. And he was just a big disappointment. Things just didn't go his way, mainly because he refused to change leads. And I kept writing about it in Derby Dozen. I said, if only this horse cannot change leads. And Dale Roman said, well, he changes in the morning. Well, I don't care. He doesn't change them in the afternoons. And he always managed to get himself beat, and he had a couple of rough trips in his last time. Well, I tell you, the Attachment Rate we saw is even better than I thought he was. I thought he ran a tremendous, tremendous race. He showed a turn of foot on the far turn that I've never seen from him before. He just accelerated unbelievably. And again, he's not going to beat Art Collector, but he finished over 5 lengths ahead of the third horse, and he galloped out past Art Collector going into the turn. He was very strong, and he's a totally different horse. And if you start looking at the speed figures, I mean, he ran faster than the winner. Very close to the winner, and he ran a very fast number in there. And it was a big, big jump from his previous start. So I think we've seen a new and improved version of Attachment Rate, and with his pedigree, he could be a real sleeper in the Derby. I wouldn't be surprised if he runs a big race. So there's your 4 horses right there. Throw in Honor AP, and to me, that's your top. That's your top 5.
It makes perfect sense, actually, and I'm glad you touched on Attachment Rate, because I thought he ran well, and we've kind of been waiting for him. And going back to, you know, early in the winter when Dale really showed confidence in him and was placing him aggressively. Caracaro, I actually got a couple of minutes, Steve, with Gustavo Delgado as he came off the racetrack, and his English has gotten much better. When we go back the last couple of years, his son would handle things for publicity and conversation, but it's gotten much easier to talk to Gustavo. And I said, you got to be happy with that, even though, you know, he said, absolutely. He said, now you know that he's, you know, he's the mile and a quarter, you got that to work with. And he said, listen, we've had all kinds of delays and different things. He's healthy now. He's doing great. And with this under a belt, he said, this is a really nice horse. And so I was impressed as well, because that's one of those situations where there's such a space between the winner and the rest of the field that everybody sort of, shrugs their shoulders at the also-rans.
Yeah, he's only going to get better. And again, you just look at these the performances of these two runner horses, and these are the kind of horses that you like to look for in the Derby. Horses that are really showing an improvement and just getting better and better. And like I said before, listen, Attachment Rate got beat over three lengths in the race, so I mean it's pretty sound. Art Collector got a quarter on the third riff. And Attachment Rate got a half. And that's very, very narrow for a horse that was beaten three lengths. And not only that, but Attachment Rate, who had been running fours his whole life, and he ran a five in his last start, to jump from a five to a half, that's a huge... I don't think it's a thing where he can't duplicate that in 4 weeks. I just think he's gotten that much better because he showed me so many different aspects of himself in this race that I'd never seen before, especially that turn of foot. If you watch that race, just watch him explode on the turn. I said, oh, my God, Attachment Rate's going to win this race. Of course, Art Collector asserted himself in the stretch. He's a better horse right now. But, boy, you look at Attachment Rate's pedigree, don't count this horse out. Dale Romans, too. It's at his home race. It's at his home track. And he's got a bit of advantage there. So I'm certainly including Attachment Rate in all my bets, as well as Caracaro. Not only that, by the way, but did you see the way Caracaro was bet? Caracaro went from, in one flash, went from 18 to 1 to 11 to 1. So, whoa. So somebody put a ton of money on this horse. That's a big, big jump in New York.
Yep. Now the adjustments, there's 70% of the pool comes in the last 2-3 minutes, last 3 minutes.
Yeah, somebody was waiting. Somebody went, and I was looking at it. At one point he was like 26 to 1, then he was 22 to 1, then he's 18 to 1, then 11 to 1. Wow. But this is already shaping up, I'll tell you. After that, you've got a lot of horses that you can throw in. And New York Traffic is going to run his race. He's always right there. He's going to be in the mix. He's going to be there at the eighth pole because he keeps running strongly. And I'm stubborn as heck. I still haven't given up on... Excuse me, on Soli Volante. I just I like the way Patrick Bianconi's trained this horse. And I like his philosophy. I had a long talk with him, so I'm still not giving up on this horse, even though there's a lot of things that I don't like as far as the logistics and the historical standpoint. But I still believe in this horse a lot. And then after that, you've got all these horses that you can throw in there. You got to throw in, if you're looking for the quintessential Dallas Stewart horse, you look at a horse like Enforceable, like we talked about, finishing second at 33 to 1, 34 to 1, whatever it is, that could be your horse if you're looking for that, looking at Lee type of horse.
Right. Well, of course, they've got Winning Impression, who you may have a Dallas horse to utilize.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, he's got to step up. He might not be 30. He might be 40 or 50 to 1. But, I was expecting more things from him, a couple of months ago. He hasn't quite moved forward as much as I thought he would. But, I think he still has the talent, but he'll be a big, big price, if he runs. I mean, I don't know how he'll run in the race.
Well,
thing is, we're running out of points. We got one last ditch on Saturday with Pneumatic trying to get in. He only has to finish first or second.
He's in now. He's in now, Steve. If he wants to run, he's got plenty.
Well, if you take out some of the horses, I'm talking about he's 22 now. But I mean, obviously, Swiss Skydive is not going to run. Obviously, Chivalry is not going to run, and we don't know about Storm the Court yet. Coming off the grass, and we don't know about Anno Dor yet. So, he should get in. But I'm just saying, if you're just looking strictly at the points, if you want to officially put him in the race at this point, he would need to win and finish second, and he should in this field. It's not that strong a field.
Well, and, you know, Finnick the Fierce is looking at all three of the three-year-old races, the Pat Day, the American Turf, and Derby. You mentioned Storm the Court, and there's some hints right now that, in fact, that the Peter Urton and the camp might be leaning more Derby. We had Michael McCarthy yesterday regarding Rushy, and Pat Day, mile, an opportunity for him. However, Michael said he's training Rushy as if he's running 10 furlongs. So that did not go unnoticed. Waiting for official word on Dr. Post, feels like
why they wouldn't run. Dr.
I agree.
Post. I don't know if Dr. Post wants to go a mile and a quarter, but you know he has the credentials to get in the Derby. And you can believe, by the way, that Derek Lawson, Fabian Pratt's agent, is talking them and Peter Urton into going Derby. I mean, listen, the one thing with Storm the Court, you know, he was second, and he was fairly well beaten in the La Jolla, but I thought he was running very strongly at the end. I liked the way he was running at the end. Sometimes you don't look at the margin that a horse gets beat. You look at how he's running. You look at the extension of his stride. And I thought he was running well, and the turf-to-dirt angle might be what he needs to wake him up. He just hasn't had that oomph this year. Well, not that he's ever had the oomph, but he just hasn't moved forward, obviously, from the way a champion 2-year-old would, but he does have the pedigree, and he's got tactical speed. I don't know if he's got the closing power to win the Derby, but if they want to run him, he's the champ. If they want to go that route, it's either that or the Del Mar Derby, which is also fairly enticing for him, which I think he could win. But it'll be interesting. All these horses you can throw in a barrel, just pick out of the hat. After you get from the top two, then you got a gap to maybe 3, 4, 5, maybe up to 6, mostly 3, 4, 5. And after that you can just pick out of a hat.
Steve, I've got to slip out because I've got three yet to visit with, including John Sadler and Tony and Rich Hang. But
let me just sneak in. By the way, there's a horse I love in the Alabama. I just want to throw that in there.
Go ahead.
And again, beating Swiss Skydiver is not going to be easy, and it's really, really every filly in this race really looks good. And Swiss Skydiver, I'm not sure if she's a mile and a quarter horse. She's not really bred for it, but we'll see. But I'll tell you, a horse sitting on a huge race here is Spice is Nice. I love the way she's coming
into
this race.
Look at you.
Yeah. I just think she at a price. This is a fairly, she won her debut, her career debut by 12 lengths, going a mile, which I love to see. And she wasn't ready to handle toneless shape in the Devona Dale next time out. And I think something happened to her in the Gulfstream Park Oaks because, she's been out for like 3.5 months. But she came back with a big, big effort at Belmont Park, one going away. And I thought she ran a super race there. She's by Curlin out of a Bernardini mare. She's a $1 million yearling. I think she's bred to go a mile and a quarter. I think she's sitting on a huge race here. So
look at you.
I just throw that in there. Spice is nice at a price.
This is getting more and more interesting because we've had Envotanti get some love already, and I know that Andy's already, he's been beating the drum on Harvey's Little Goyle all winter, and he's gonna push Harvey's Little Goyle, and we know
he's a good filly too. Again, the turf to dirt is good. She's an excellent filly herself. It certainly wouldn't surprise me if she won. But it's a good, really good field.
Nice field of seven, no doubt. Oh, and Bonnie South, nothing wrong with Bonnie South.
No, every one of them.
Jesus.
Ball.
Yep.
She ran a tremendous race for Baffert in the coaching club, American Oaks.
Yep.
It's just wild having the Alabama run 3 weeks before the Kentucky Oaks. That's kind of weird.
It could be a terrific way to propel you in. You're going to end up with Gamine stretching from 7 to 9, and then you probably have a couple of these coming back from 10 to 9.
Zero filly, come back from a mile and a quarter to a mile and eighth.
It's crazy.
Weeks. I mean, that's asking a lot. So we'll have to see how this race unfolds.
You know what? I'm going to use that as
like Spice is Nice. who's lightly raced with only four starts. You know, if she, even if she runs a big race here, I can certainly see her dropping back. But you know, it's funny that Pletcher and the Lowe's could win this race, and they could possibly win the Belmont Derby with million-dollar yearlings, because they, you know, they're also going to be represented in the Belmont Derby, which is a phenomenal field.
Yeah,
but
nice
they've got Colonel Liam in there, coming off a big win in his grass debut, got 100 buyer in there, so that would be unbelievable. Can you imagine if he went back-to-back grade ones with million-dollar yearlings?
Well, a decorated Invader going to be
very tough
in there, based on everything we've seen coming into this. But Guffo, also from the Clement Barn, and Field Pass, who's a serious horse in his own
domestic
right.
Domestic spending.
Yep. It's a very good group. Saturday, another great card, absolutely. And
yep,
also, Steve,
looking forward to it.
As we bring in Tony, I do want to mention Brady Lucas gave everybody the heads up that D-Wayne, positive for COVID.
Yes, I saw that.
And he's home. He's resting. Everything seems okay. And I really appreciated
God bless him for that. I mean, you know, at his age, you always have to be worried. But, you know, that man is made out of steel. I mean, he is not his age. I mean, what is he going to be, 85, I think? And you look at him, and you could think that he's in his 60s. I mean, he's still Wayne, so he's tough. And, you know, for him to fight this thing off is a testament to that.
Well, and he had been away from the barn, actually, a couple of days, even before a symptom appeared. But he, knock on wood, everything, hope, you know, he's staying home. He's not hospitalized, so that alone is a positive. So everybody's sending out thoughts and best wishes to D. Wayne. Steve, I appreciate it, and we will have pretty close to a Derby field to peruse next week.
Yeah, good to be back in the fold again, and you know, analyzing it and watching it, and it's gonna be fascinating. Even if it turns out to be a, you know, big two horse showdown, there's nothing wrong with that.
No,
easy go with Sunday Silence Derby. You know, nothing wrong with having a big showdown like that. You got the the big New York horse against the Pride of Kentucky.
Well, in the meantime, I'm going to give you a story idea, because it came up earlier with Jay. How about a Snowchief Ferdinand rivalry? Why isn't that a better? Why isn't
exactly
that a more heralded rivalry?
Yeah, and you know what? And the one thing that Jay Humphrey had said, by the way, which you know, I agree. I don't know if I'd use the word the Eastern elite, but there is a bit of snobbishness in there, and there's a bit of ignorance when it comes to when it comes to the California horses, but. Precisionist and Granton, you're not going to get a better rivalry than that.
Yep.
That's a rivalry nobody knows about. And that was an incredible, incredible rivalry, what those horses did. But you're right, Snowchief and Ferdinand, and you know, and Ferdinand beating Snowchief going 7 furlongs in the Malibu, which should have shocked everybody. But like I always said, the Malibu, that 7 furlong race, is more about class than it is about pure speed.
I'm gonna talk about some distance concept with Tony. Just got a few minutes with him, Steve. I appreciate it. And obviously, we would keep going because that's what we do. But we'll pull up, and I'll talk next week.
Okay, Steve. Take care.
It's Steve Askin, and you can hear it in his voice. He's born again hard and fresh. And now it's Secretariat.com's Steve Askin. And we'll stay right here. We're going to stay right here all the way till noon. And I should mention, I was waiting for those scratches, and now I'm irked, because Turn of Events is coming out of this eighth race. I was really going to kind of linchpin around the day, the sequence. I thought Luis Saez on that horse was just going to absolutely lull everybody. Not that that was a, you know, was some sort of a hidden agenda, but it was pretty obvious. But Turn of Events comes out of that eighth race, and now you got to figure out where the speed's going to come from and so forth. Tony Black standing by. Tony, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. And I heard you talking about Ferdinand and about winning going 7/8 of a mile unexpectedly. Well, I always love riding true distance horses backed up to a 7/8 race, because you know one thing about it, they'll run every step of the way, and especially if a trainer has them real sharp and cranked up, they even lay close and run every step of the way. So it does happen. And I heard you talking about Snow Chief. Snow Chief, that was John Macbeth now, wasn't it? Didn't he ride Snow Chief?
You mean in the Preakness? Alex Solis.
Oh, Solis rode Snow Chief. I was thinking Macbeth rode him somewhere along the line, but maybe he didn't. But, I never had the opportunity to meet Mel Studi, but I did have the opportunity to meet Telly Savalas one time when I came to California to ride my Juliet at Santa Anita. And he was talking to, I think, Shoemaker or Pinkay over by the jocks room. And I was coming out, or just going into jocks room, and I had an opportunity to say, hey, Telly, how you doing, Greek? And he didn't answer me. But that's my meeting with Telly Savalas. And when you guys were talking about Telly, Pop, and those horses, there was a horse running on the East Coast named Kojak, I believe. And Kojak was a runner, kind of a runner. And I think Tony Aganella rode him, and I think Sonny Hines trained him. And they won some major stake with Kojak. And that was named after the series that Telly was in, Kojak. So he was really popular in the horse racing game because he was such a star, Telly Savalas, and especially in the mid-70s or late-70s, whatever
it
was.
You bet.
He was big name, and I just thought I was honored just to walk past him while I was going in or out of the jocks room at Santa Anita to ride my Juliet. It was just a thrill to see him in person.
And that, the Kojak that you're talking about was a Maryland bred, actually, right?
Won
Malibu. Yeah, one of Malibu in 77.
I know you have all the stats. I'm just reaching back to my memory, which, you hit the ground enough times, you get a lot of concussions, your memories get lost. But I think Tony Aganella rode him, and I think Sonny Hines trained him, if I remember.
Sonny Hines, yeah, Sonny trained him. Sonny trained him.
See, every once in a while, things stick up there. So I just couldn't help but to remember that horse, and I knew it had nothing to do with Mel Studi, but the Telly Savalas and Telly's Pop.
The Kojak tie-in, yeah.
The Kojak tie-in.
It was Kojak. It was spelled differently, though. It was not with a K. It was C-O-J-A-K.
Yeah, that's what I had. But it was in reference, because everybody knew it, to the series that Telly
was
in. I guess they didn't get permission to use the exact
probably
spelling,
that makes sense.
And they spelled it different, but everybody knew what it meant. But and I believe Aganella wrote him, and he's another name in the history of past history of racing in Maryland. And he was a half mile riding son of a gun, and I knew him real well. And the first stake race that Barkley Tagg won was at Marlboro Racetrack, and I finished in a dead heat with a horse called Ginger Mint and Tony Aganello. And that was Barkley Tagg's first stakes winner as a trainer. And it was the Governor's Cup, I believe it was. And the dead heat, it was a big pot at Marlboro Racetrack. They had a few big races. The Marlboro Nursery was the biggest. And this was kind of a prep to the Marlboro Nursery. And the big pot, 15,000. I think it might have been added. It was either 15,000. But I finished in a dead heat with Tony Aganello in Barkley Tagg's first stake winner with Sherbrooke.
Sherbrooke, and you sent me the picture. In fact, I've had you sent me this once before. I'll put it up. Everybody will love it.
I didn't know if I did, but every time I hear about Barkley Tagg, and I'm sure rooting for him with Tis the Law, because he was so impressive. And I really respect Mr. Askins' analysis of races and of horses, and he's spot on. He's a nice horse. Tis the Law, and a couple of them may will have to beat him, but. Boy, Haskin, he hits the nail right on the head. He's one of the best information sources for horse racing, and whether it's watching the races, betting the races, or analyzing their breeding to see if they'll have an affinity for turf or dirt or whatever, the man is spot on. He's one of my favorites, and you being the other. My favorite when it comes to analyzing horse racing. I don't want to leave you out of this scenario.
Thank you, buddy. Tony, speaking of favorites, one of your favorites today in the feature here at Saratoga, you got in the Union Avenue, Collegeville Girl. She's a price, and she's an overlay in there today to me.
I believe so. I know she's doing real well. They wouldn't ship her up there, and she's had some experience at Saratoga and shipping in the New York. I think she's yet. You know how you run a horse a few times, and you say, boy, there's still more to that horse. And I haven't been getting on her, but she trains even better than she's run in her winning races. So there's still more to her, Steve. And one day, even though you say, well, she's had enough time to show it, but you never know what makes these horses tick. And I haven't been on her in a while, but I always loved breezing her. And at times when you breezed her, she would get too much on the bit. And I said, when this filly really learns to relax, and a few times I broke her off with the pony, and she really relaxed breathing. And she wasn't strictly speed. She was versatile. But a few times when she relaxed in the early stages of the work, she finished and would go the last eight after a half mile or whatever, in like 11 and change, 12, and just explode underneath you if you got her to relax the first part. And then I always thought, like 7/8 is a great distance for her, because there's a lot of times you make the lead easier going 7/8 than you do any other distance, because people always want to sit and say, well, I'll be running at the end. Yeah, you'll be running at the end, and if you leave the speed long enough alone on the lead, you'll be running at the end, and guess who else will be running at the end, because you sat and figured your horse would outfinish him the last 8, the horse that you left alone on the lead. But she's versatile. She doesn't have to be on the lead, and I think, like, you hit it right on the head. She's definitely an overlay, and I think she's going to run real well today.
It's a nice little group, and there is speed. The key, it's funny. The key is going to be what happens between Ratajkowski inside. Jose Ortiz is going to have to go, and Carrera Cat coming off the layoff with Kendrick Carmouche, who pretty much only knows one way of going, and that is go, go, go. Carrera Cat,
I influenced him over the years when he started riding.
That's it. Absolutely. He watched you. He was watching you so much in Philly.
Yeah, he used to get so PO'd at me because I'd let him roll, and then he would come up on the inside, and I'd make him go around. Wouldn't bother him, just make him go around. And he would even tell kids walking in the jocks room, whatever you do, wherever he's at, go around him, because that's where you'll wind up in the anyway, if you try to get through. And he would tell kids that weren't riding every day at parks or Philadelphia Park, whatever it was at the time. But it used to crack me up. But he's turned out where he's done quite well. And you know what? He is a versatile rider, but he's very strong when he does let him roll. But the key to that race is going to be what happens and what instinctual feel the jock on Collegeville Girl has. If there is that attitude of let's just sit and wait, she can't go. And if there is someone who is pressing it and really wanting to go, or one or two of them that really want to go, she will relax and look at horses. The one thing you never want to do with her is if you're trying to slow her down in the early stages and grabbing her too hard, she'll grab you as hard as you want to grab her, and all she'll be doing is through dynamic tension. And you're pulling, she's pulling, and guess what? Everybody runs out of energy in the late stages of the race. If you can get her to prick her ears and look at a horse or a couple horses, she'll do that. I wish, at one point, even though it's, I'm done, I wish that I had the opportunity to ride her once or twice, because then I would even know more about her. But this is just by being on her in the morning. She will look at horses, and if she relaxes in the early stages of a race, she will finish. The only thing I'm not sure of, if you can look at a horse, you're always more comfortable looking at speed or a couple speed horses from the outside, stalking in a strategically placed position. You're always more comfortable with that with horses. But if you were jammed on the inside, I don't know how she would react to that. But she has what? She's in the, what is it?
She's in the four hole. She's fine. And Manny.
And that's my
Manny
favorite number. That's my lucky number for you now.
All right.
In fact, my son bred a horse to Smarty Jones. It was a mare that I had gotten on one day at Val McNeely's farm, and it was just as a pleasure ride because I broke my arm and was just coming back. And my ex-wife said, come on over and ride with Tony and me. So I went over there and rode, and I got on this mare that had never been bred. And a beautiful way of going, didn't race, you know, broke down before she ever got to the races. And I says, where'd you get this horse? Well, Val McNeely gave her to me. I said, well, why don't you breed her? And they bred her. The horse ran last night at Penn National, and she's been said to be strictly a grass horse, Market 3 out of Smarty Jones, by Smarty Jones out of Market 3 mare. And she ran first time on the grass last night and finished second. She hasn't been able to break her maiden sheep for $10,000 on the dirt. They ran her on the grass like I told them, try her on the grass. She ran last night on the grass, finished second, and it was for like 17 down to 16, ran a good race. So I said, well, grass does mean something. But horse racing is an interesting game. You just never know where it takes you.
Well, and Tony, when we talk next week, I do want to have the conversation. John Sadler is going to join us here momentarily, and we'll come back to you next week. I want you to discuss, and it'd be perfect, after the Alabama, we'll know which of those fillies coming out of this weekend are thinking about, you know, cutting back from 10 to 9. And then, of course, there's Gamine coming out of the big performance in the test, 7/8. She had backed up from 8 to 7, from the Acorn to the test, and now she's going to stretch out from 7 to 9. And I want you to address the challenges and what, you know, what elements go into that. And, getting a horse to relax from 7 to 9 is tough.
Love both those scenarios. And I just forgot to tell you, that horse last night was the number 4 horse, too.
I figured that was that. That's what must have prompted. That must have prompted you, right? I figured.
Yeah. All right. We'll be looking forward to it next week, Steve.
Tony Black, everybody, and we wish Richie Vega and the team behind the Collegeville Girl today a lot of luck. I get to see him. I won't see him today, but because we got the kids visiting with the baby. But you know, I usually get a chance to go out and say hi, Sal DeBunda and the Brittinghams and company, and of course Andy Bednall bred this one. He breeds a good horse. We're staying right here. John Sadler is joining us, and one of the names that came up among West Coast, just the community of horsemen, and John Sadler as a person that would pay tribute and respected and appreciated Mel Studi. John, good morning.
Good morning.
I appreciate the visit, and we talked to Jay Hovde and Jay Privman earlier, and it seems that I could really reach out anywhere and find people to speak glowingly of Mel Studi.
Well, Mel Studi, the word I would use would be beloved. It's beloved by the horse racing community in California, that's for sure. He was a great guy, one of the kind of the guys that kind of built this circuit, you know, from the early days on, and, you know, he supported it with his dollars, you know, loved to gamble, loved to go to the races, loved to go to dinner. He was a fixture here, that's for sure.
When you came into the game, and there were still, you know, there was still a generation, a group of elder statesmen, even at that point, when you think Studi and Whittingham, Noble Trewitt, and there's others, certainly, you know, watching horsemen like that, what do you learn and what do you emulate?
Well, the guys I came in under were great mentors. They were all really good horsemen, and they were all unique. So I think of that table at Hollywood Park where it would be Warren Studi, Mel Studi, Brian Mayberry, B. Wayne Hughes, Henry Marino. You know, these were guys that came up the hard way, you know, through life and through business and horses. And they were very instrumental to me, always willing to guide me in the right direction and you know, very opinionated guys would tell you exactly what they thought. And I think they told management what they thought. You know, they were well-respected.
Hmm.
And all really good horsemen. You know, Mel fell into the category of he wasn't getting the horses. You know, he didn't have the big-time connections. In that era, would have been Charlie Whittingham and Tommy Doyle and Laz Barrera. But Mel would did really well with the horses he got, and he got some better horses and got on a good run there in the 80s. You know, he won two Breeders' Cups. He won the Preakness. I mean, you know, Snow Chief was bred in a backyard in Temecula. I don't think he ever saw a day of grass in his life, you know, come from a dirt paddock. And Mel had a really good run in there, and he was, nobody enjoyed it more than him.
That's for sure. And, my own experience just coming, you know, the last 15 years coming out there and, that table, that corner table, at Clocker's Corner and, Mel holding court, Barry Abrams and Gary and Yip in there and all the, it's sort of an indelible. I wish there was a painting or some sort of a watercolor drawing of that group. It sort of personified coming out to California is one of the first things that I would always see every morning, and it's really indelible to me. It's very special.
I mean,
on
the,
that
the,
front
the stories you could tell on Mel, you need hours, you know. It was just so classic. He loved to tell the story that I was stabled next to him there for quite a few years at Hollywood Park, and after the last race, I went over one day, and I'd run a couple favorites, and they both run fifth, and I was just down. I said, Mel, how do you do it? He looked at me, and he says, John, you do it looking through a bottle, the scotch. He says, get the scotch in that cup and throw out that soda. It won't look so bad. He had great answers for everything. You know, it's funny, you know, he would come back to the barn at Hollywood Park, and, you know, it's not politically correct to say it anymore, but he'd been at the races all day, and then before they left to drive back home, they had another drink at the barn, then got on the freeway. But different era, you know, different era sensibilities and everything like that, so a different time, but he was a great guy.
John, I got to ask one question that came up earlier because Mallaire and her unbelievable performance. Talk about how Mel reacted when you beat him.
Well, he was gracious as usual. You know, I thought I had him going into that race. I thought Snow Chief might be a little bit tired coming off the Triple Crown stuff. And that was a special day for me, and for her to be a great horse like Snow Chief was just an unbelievable kind of a turning point in my career.
Jay Privman earlier, too, he cites it as one of, in his whole career, in his life as a fan of racing, he says one of the most remarkable performances he's ever seen anywhere.
Yeah, it really was. It was a freaky performance. She ran, I mean, think about this. I mean, she ran 7/8 and 19-4, you know, sub-120 for 7, and went 32-4. I think it was like the second or third fastest filly and mare race for a mile. The stats on it were just unbelievable. So one-turn mile. But she was just really a very special horse, probably too fast for her own good. Got injured after that, and then got colic on the farm. But that was a great day for me, and that was an exciting day at the races at Hollywood Park. That's for sure.
Did Mel took it in stride? He didn't give you the business.
He was good. You know, he was a gentleman all the time. You know, really, you probably always a gentleman. That's for sure.
John, I appreciate it. I'm looking forward when the time's right to have Gary on, and Gary undoubtedly has got he's probably got a book to write if he wanted. And Alex Solis, who you know owes really a lot of the establishment right of his career to Mel too. So
about Gary. Gary's been a great son. They've been a great family. They had Mel at home all the time, and were right there when he passed away yesterday morning.
Yeah.
So they've been very supportive, and you know it's not easy. You know, at the end with those guys that are you know tough guys and self-made guys to have their family help them like that. They've taken care of the family for so many years, and again, I'm going to give a lot of props to them.
I'm glad you acknowledge that. Let me ask you before you go too about Saturday. We haven't had a chance to talk this summer. Park Avenue looks like a very promising firster, the filly on Saturday.
Yeah, I'm really excited about her. She's a really nice 2-year-old filly, to a little bit inside for my liking, but she's definitely a prospect. That's for sure.
Well, and she's been working right along, including a nice gate blast about 10 days ago, and looks well-schooled. She's a quality road out of an Indian Charlie mare, and Flavian Pratt has got the call. Was a $450,000 purchase. You've also got, on Friday, you got that Run Sappy, too. Oh, I guess we lost John. All right, Casey, we'll save John's horse conversation for when he has got some winners. To not that he doesn't have winners on a regular basis, but I did want to get that Park Avenue in. It's a good name too. Quality Road Philly on Saturday at Santa Anita. 15 minutes to fill out what's been a nonstop conversation set, and Rich Eng joining us from Las Vegas. Rich, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Rich, got any number of things I could throw at you, including the sports betting landscape and how things are going in Vegas. Then, of course, we're coming out from Travers, a pretty funny time in August to be recapping Travers. But your thoughts and what do you think as we lurch toward Derby?
Well, I tell you what, first I'll touch upon the local market because, you know, people are always interested about what's going on in Las Vegas. And as they're well aware, we shut down our casinos on March 17th, and then some of them were allowed to reopen on June 4th, and slowly but surely more and more are opening. The strip traffic, in all candor, has not returned to normal. So they're a little underachieving on the strip right now, but a lot of the locals' places are doing pretty well. And, you know, now that we have sports coming back in a way, the NHL is in the middle of their Stanley Cup playoffs, thank goodness. The NBA is just getting ready, I believe, to start their playoffs and having the end of the regular season games. And we'll see what happens with football. It looks like some of these college conferences are dropping out from playing this fall, but the NFL insists they're going to go on. So, you know, as long as we have those major sports, that helps fill up our sports book, and in turn, that helps our race business because, as you all know, most of the race and sports books are built side by side so that the traffic goes both ways. So, we're doing better. We're doing better in that regard, Steve.
Now, it's a bit of a slog, obviously, and I saw a feature. I don't know what it was on. It was on one of those unconventional news shows, It the restrictions and the safety measures really, understandably, make it awkward to really execute and to offer the same amenity and really the pleasure, frankly, of what people enjoy about the experience.
Yeah, you know, some of the staples that are not available right now is none of the buffets in Vegas anywhere. Are open to the public.
Sure.
Wynn actually, they did something unique with their buffet. They've got one of the best buffets in the city, Wynn Las Vegas. But what they do is they have waiter service at the buffet so that the food is there, but the patrons, the customers, are not allowed to get up out of their seat and serve themselves. They have to tell the waiter, what they would like to eat, and then the waiter fills the plate and brings it back. So in a way, it's kind of a controlled measure for the buffet. But at least people get to eat that scrumptious food.
Well, sort of, it's for lazy buffet goers.
It's more of a convenience takeout buffet.
Well, and that, you know, you do see that already. You know, frankly, on the sports concessionaire elements, everything is coming pre-packaged, and there's actually a certain efficiency, I guess, to it. I mean, obviously, it's a burden to the operations, but I'm amazed at the speed with which and the innovation of which has been executed toward so many different dining establishments and operations. I mean, even close by, we've got an ice cream stand that normally people will queue up. And they've eliminated that. You got to stay in your car, and essentially they're car hops going back and forth, taking the order, and doing an amazing job keeping a line going, two lines. People are adjusting and trying to work through it. And what choice do we have? And meanwhile, you know, the first sign of real excitement, it seems to me, Rich, when it came to the sports, the straight sports side, was the 5 overtime game the other night that had people captivated. And in fact, Jay Privman, I wasn't aware the game was going on. I had a thing we had the fundraiser for the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, and I had just come in, and Jay Privman sent me a text. He goes, "Are you watching this hockey game?" And I said, "No, I just walked in." He goes, "They're going to they were only going to the fourth overtime at that point." But it seemed that sort of got people going. And listen, Stanley Cup playoff hockey is the best, maybe the best sports championship sequence of any sport. There's nothing like Stanley Cup playoff hockey. It is end-to-end and just full throat. And this was really, watching some of this has been the first time I feel engaged. The baseball has not interested me an ounce.
Yeah, you know, obviously here in Vegas, we've got the Vegas Golden Knights, who did a number on the Chicago Blackhawks the other night, and I think they play again at 3:00 Pacific time in Game 2. But it looks on paper, and what we saw on the ice is kind of a mismatch. I was watching that overtime game too. And you know what? I actually was thinking about you, because I'm thinking, here's announcers that have to broadcast the game for more than 6 hours. That's a lot of talking, Steve.
You know what? It's funny you say that. It's funny. You think about the playoff, you know, the players that are just limping along. It was Tampa and Columbus, for those that didn't, that weren't, that weren't aware. But not exactly the original six, by the way, the Lightning and the Blue Jackets. It's not exactly, you know, Blackhawk Red Wing hockey, but it still made for excitement. I can remember, I was a kid, Rich, and you were growing up in Stamford, and I was growing up outside of Hartford, and I remember going to bed, the Mets. I was listening to a Met game on the radio, and then, you know, Bob Murphy, Ralph Kiner, and Lindsey Nelson. And I literally that trite ism of, you know, listening to a transistor radio under the pillow or, you know, in bed. And I remember the game was late, and I remember waking up at like 2:30 in the morning, and I don't know what possessed me to turn the radio on, but it was the game when the Mets went, I think, 18 or 19 innings.
Well, I know the Mets had a 23 inning game earlier in their career, earlier in their lifespan, and I got a real quick 20 side story about that. Was I was a little kid, and we were watching the game on WOR Channel 9. It was the Mets and the Giants, and it was a doubleheader, and we left to go out, And we went to the Starlight Drive-In Theater in Stanford. We saw a couple of movies. And when we came back at night, it was really late, and we were kind of tired. It was like 11:30. Turn on the TV, and they're still playing.
So exactly. Exactly.
Mets Giants second game of the doubleheader.
Well, and that that's a game that's on the their list, and I'm just looking at the list of the longest Met games. I'm going to guess it may have been this game against the Cardinals that went 25 innings.
Wow. In
September 11th, 1974. The 24 inning game was the Astros beat them 1-0 in 1968, mm-hmm. Early in the season. In the Astrodome, Giants Mets, 23 innings, 7 hours, 23 minutes in 1964.
Yep, I remember that as a little kid. But
funny.
The way they're doing baseball now with the extra innings, the runners starting on second base, I get the feeling we're not going to see that scenario at least this year.
the players don't. I've read where the players aren't thrilled about that concept. It's essentially like the field goal concept that's been kicked around in 1AA and stuff. Anyway, I, as usual, we got far afield. Rich, some quick either some Travers thoughts and maybe a couple of opinions for today.
Well, you know, as far as the Travers thought, I saw what everybody else saw. I mean, Sid the Law just put these horses in his hip pocket and said goodbye. So, the fact that the distance of the race was 1.25 miles, you don't have that question mark going into the Kentucky Derby, whether he can get the distance or not. And, I'll be willing to give Uncle Chuck another chance, but I tell you what, he just didn't perform. He didn't show up. Honor AP is a horse that I'll give a second chance, even though he got beat the other day. And Art Collector looked pretty good winning. But, Tis the Law is going to be one of the shortest priced Derby favorites in a long, long time. Whether they get 20 horses or not, he is going to be a short price favorite, like even money, that kind of thing.
Feels like it. And I keep going back to the storyline pitting potentially one of the storylines pitting Derby winning trainers John Sheriffs and Barkley Tagg. That have a century and a half of life experience between them.
Old school trainers. We love
them. Big time. All right. We've got about 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Let's pick out a spot or two, Rich.
Yeah, I'll give two horses that are in the early pick five at Saratoga. I did a Saratoga sheet today that's available at the racedaylasvegas.com website. But the first horse I'll give is in race two. I love this condition. In the second race at Saratoga today, it's a restricted maiden special weight, but it's for horses that have sold or reserve not attained for $45,000 or less. So
right.
You won't see any million-dollar backward babies showing up in here. But I'm going to go with the number 8 horse, Malibu Luna. A lot of times just having that one race experience is a huge advantage over all the first-time starters. And this horse has been training well for Bill Mott. So that'll be my first horse, number 8, Malibu Luna. In the second at Saratoga. And the other horse I'll give, let's go to race number 4. It's 1.5 miles, so they're going two turns. And the horse I'm going to give out is the number 2 horse, Blood Moon. Has got a lot of speed and looks like that's the potential to be low and early speed, stretching out for Danny Gargan and Luis Saez. But I'm looking for this horse to go wire to wire in the fourth race, number 2, Blood Moon.
Well, and that's a scenario. You bring that up, and the Spidale family. It's funny that they've had 2 wins now at the meet, and they. I was really touched by. I don't know if people saw the interview the other day. They've gotten into the game. To celebrate, and I retweeted something, or I acknowledged their first win at Saratoga, and it was really moving, actually. They started a racing team, Spidale Family Racing, to honor their late father, and they're clearly excited about the game, and every time I look down now. I mean, they've had a very active Saratoga. And in fact, Gargan had a little bit of a slow start. And now looking down, going into today, 19 starts, 3 wins, 3 seconds, 4 thirds. So his horses are running well now. When you look at that collectively.
Yeah, that's an outstanding record. And, you know, when I see Danny Gargan in the entries, it makes me feel old because I remember Danny Gargan as a jockey, not as a trainer.
I'm just looking at that group, actually, Rich. this is definitely a nice scenario for Luis Saez. This is a natural for Saez to basically lull everybody. Somebody better get aggressive and go after him because this horse. On the lead, and he almost won at Gulfstream this winter. Carmouche, the horse got just run down late earlier in the meet. Who is it today on this topic? I know we got to pull up, but there's a horse today. Who is it? I wrote about it this morning that is looking for a third win already. At the meet. I think it's Quiet Out East, I think. Right?
That's a quick turnaround. I didn't notice that. But, one thing I was going to comment on is one thing I noticed in the riding styles on the turf and the dirt at Saratoga, there's a lot of snatch and hold. I mean, there's a lot of people just grabbing. So if you got some speed, you might as well just use it.
Is that Andy? Is that you, Andy Serling? It is Quiet Out East, who won for Brad Cox. Actually, no, it's not Quiet Out East. I'm wrong. What? Come on. Where is this? We're going to run out of time here. I thought I wrote about this morning.
I'm sorry. I can't help you.
No. I'll tweet about it. What the hell's wrong with me? And also, as we leave...
The music's over.
Well, the music, we're right up on top of it. Steve Crist and his partner, Foxtail. Thank you very much. Yeah, Foxtail. Good job. Exactly. That's in the six that starts the late pick five. Good luck to Steve Crist today. He's got Vivizano in the nightcap. Who's got a nice chance, and he's also got that thin white Duke coming back, turf sprinting in the two-year-old filly in the seventh. So Steve's looking for his first win ever as an owner. So good luck to Steve Crist, who you may have worked for when you were at NYRA.
We didn't cross paths when he was there, but Steve and I have known each other a long, long time.
Of course.
I knew Steve when he started the beat at the New York Times. He took over for a fellow named Jim Tewitt, and I remember Steve Crist, first day on the job as the New York Times horse racing writer.
Rich Eng, everybody. Rich Eng for Pro Pick. RacedayLasVegas.com for Rich's analysis. Today, Saratoga, and then the weekend, Del Mar, and we'll talk to Rich next week. I want to thank Jay Pridman, Jay Hubdy, and John Sadler for visiting to pay tribute to Mel Studi. Back with you tomorrow for a weekend preview. Dick Powell, of course, was with us. Steve Haskin of Secretariat.com. Tony Black and Rich. Fun 3 hours. My pick five will be up shortly at the website. Nick Tamaro's full analysis. Another good day for Nick. Nick's rolling. That's up already, and we will talk to you in the morning. Good luck, everybody. Thanks. Black sheep of the angels ride, riding down the line. We think there is a soul. We don't know. The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio. The latest thoroughbred racing news. Dial 866-454-6848 to get on board. At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Saratoga. It's history. It's tradition. It's world-class racing. It's jump racing. Yes, steeplechase racing has played a role in Saratoga's rich history and tradition since 1864. And today, it's a part of what makes Saratoga so special. Watch every Wednesday of the meet and two special Thursdays featuring the Grade 1 AP Smithick on July 23rd and the Grade 1 New York Turf Riders Cup on August 20th. Savor the thrill of horses flying over fences. Steeplechase racing, it's a Saratoga tradition.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on? University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow! What other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.